You're listening to Raphael Epstein.
Josh Nelson, well, he looks at films all week. Tough gig, Josh, welcome.
Thank you very much. It's a hard life, but someone has to do it.
He's got this pale, sallow complexion. He looks like a vampire, never sees the outside. No, he's looking rudely healthy. Look, let's talk about Minions first. Many people will not have seen the Despicable flicks, so give people the idea of where it all comes from.
So Despicable Me and Despicable Me 2 were films that centred around a character called Gru, who was a lovable villainous, sort of lovable supervillain. He had a cohort of yellow, almost anarchic creatures that live in his basement and do all his sort of dirty work for him. And they don't have a language per se. They're this strange kind of pastiche of noises. And actually, you get a greater sense of their language in this film. But they were such a hit. It was almost inevitable that this was going to be ripe for a spin-off. So now we get Minions, a film focusing on, well, three particular of the Minions.
I tell you, let's get the little... I think we're introduced to a few of these little characters. If you haven't seen it, think of them as like thimble-sized little yellow flocks of friendly but yet somehow ominous creatures. They've got that beautiful blend of weird, a little scary, quite endearing as well. Have a little listen.
Without a master, they had no purpose. They became aimless and depressed. If this went on much longer, they would surely perish.
But then one minion stepped forward.
Kevin felt pride. He was going to be the one to find his tribe the biggest, baddest villain to serve. Stuart felt hungry, mostly. He was going to be the one to eat this banana. And Bob was frightened of the journey ahead.
So you get the idea. If you haven't seen it, hopefully that gives you some of the flavour. They sound like famous voices as well.
Jeffrey Rush was the narration there. Yeah, and he's great at the narration at the beginning of this film, which gives the backstory up into the 1960s where this film predominantly takes place, covers the history of the Minions, and we hear Jeffrey at various points.
And did you like it? Did you like it? Was it good?
Look, I enjoyed it. I mean, you know, these films make me feel like a kid again, in a different way to Inside Out, and maybe we can talk a bit about that later. But I saw it in an audience of children. I went along with my junior reviewer, Luke, who wrote
How
this.
Old's Luke?
Luke is seven, uh-huh. And he wrote this wonderful and very colourful review, which he sent me today. And he actually recommends it. He says it would be good for your child to watch if they like jokes and robbers.
There you go.
So if they've got an interest in humour and criminality, then send your kids along to this film.
That is such a perversion of his review.
Well, actually, Luke loved it. In fact, Luke and I found we were laughing at very similar points in this film. And there is something quite endearing about the Minions themselves, and the way in which this film is, and it's very different to Inside Out, it's far more in, given that it's a French director, I think you could almost draw a kind of a lineage between the films of Jacques Tati and the French obsession with Jerry Lewis films and the way in which the Minions work. Because it's all about sight gags and physical
just
humor and physical comedy.
Monsieur Hulot films?
Yeah, Monsieur, yeah. Mon Uncle and so on. The director of this film, Pierre Coffin, does all the voices for the Minions, all of them.
Oh.
And I remember him talking about when he'd done Despicable Me Too and said he recorded something like 1,000 different Minion voices.
When they all go, together.
That's Pierre Coffin.
That's 1,000 of him.
That's the director.
Wow.
And you get snippets of, you know, even Indonesian. I heard one of them say, Terima kasih, at one point, and you hear, you know, Entschuldigung, and it's this strange melange of European voices.
It's fun.
It is, it's fun. And what I really noticed about this film, having seen it in the wake of Inside Out, is it has a very episodic narrative structure. So the Minions, they leave the home base from their snow overlords to seek out a new master. They end up in New York in 1968, and then suddenly they're at a villain conference in Orlando, and then they're trying to rob the crown jewels in London.
Chapters.
And it's the way in which I think children tell stories, if you think about that episodic structure. It's this happened, and then this happened, and this happened. Whereas Inside Out is more layered. It sets up all
That's far more... it's trying to do something quite different from what I understand about Inside Out.
Well, very much so. And I think the appeal of this is those immediate sight gags. It's not a film where you reflect on and talk about the textual layers of the film or the way in which it's a complex narrative that's appealing to nostalgia. It's very fun. In fact, there's a moment in here, I think the sequence, where I almost cried laughing, which doesn't happen very often. And I can't even explain why particularly, but it's a dance sequence involving the tower guards of of London that get zapped by a mind ray and start dancing and performing Hair, the 70s song Hair, and start stripping off all their clothes. Right. It's wonderful. And yeah, it's something about the sublime element of this that reminded me of that tradition of French humour.
Okay, it sounds like fun. It is a spin-off of the Despicable Me and Despicable Me 2 film, so I'm interested in your favourite spin-offs. 1300 222 774. Dan's waiting patiently in North Melbourne. Dan, what's your spin-off?
I reckon probably the best spin-off from TV is Frasier from the original series Cheers.
Yeah, I don't think there has been a more successful spin-off, has there?
Yeah, it's probably even went on throughout the 90s, and it even used to get spoofed on The Simpsons, which is always going to be a mark of being a clear winner.
That's absolutely true. A certain sign of your cultural cachet. And someone gets a prize. Your mobile ends in 146. You've signed it anonymously. You definitely get a prize. Worst spin-off film, a forgettable Star Wars telemovie Christmas special with Chewbacca's family and a dance routine in the Tatooine bar. 100% you win. And both from Happy Days, Mork and Mindy, best spin-off, worst ever, Chachi Loves Jody. That's from Jason in Seaford. Is Mork and Mindy a spin-off of Happy Days?
It is. He was a regular cameo performer in Happy Days. Oh. When they were, I think this is post-Jumping the Shark. This is post-Fonzie flying over the sharks.
Yeah. And it was Chachi Loves Jody?
Jeez, I don't remember that.
But I remember the spin-off. I'm not sure if Jodie's the right name, but I definitely remember the
Laverne
spin-off.
Laverne and Shirley, that was a spin-off too, wasn't it? Or something from... Yeah, I think so. I think, weren't they characters in Happy Days?
No.
Or characters in some other verse?
They're in Milwaukee, yeah. Because I watched the Waynesworld the other day.
That's right.
And there's the spoof.
The montage Laverne at the beginning,
yeah. The credits, fantastic. Look, quarter to five on 774 ABC Melbourne. We're going to get into Going Clear in a moment. It's not good when you've got two or three of the spokesmen for the Church of Scientology appearing in a documentary about Scientology saying just how dreadful and terrible it is.
You're listening to Raphael Epstein.
So Going Clear is the new documentary about the Church of Scientology. It's based on a great book from a really incredibly prolific and highly credible journalist called Lawrence Wright. The filmmaker is Alex Gibney, the name was about to escape me, who also did a great documentary on the person who leaked all of the secrets to WikiLeaks, Bradley, now Chelsea Manning. Josh, we'll play a little bit of the film, but first give people an idea. What do you feel like the film's attempting to do? What's the basic setup of what you get?
Look, I think it's maybe worthwhile putting this film in the context of Gibney's other documentaries. He has an interest in, I think, institutions and exposing certain institutions or institutional practices within things like the Catholic Church. And he had that fantastic documentary the year before last, I think, Mea Maxima Culpa, Silence in the House of God. He's done documentaries on Enron, on the US military, Taxi to the Dark Side. And also he has an interest in charismatic leaders, like Lance Armstrong was his last documentary. Within WikiLeaks, we get that sense of Assange. And the WikiLeaks is interesting as a comparison to this one because of the focus on Chelsea Manning. And we have what is the effect of those people who leave those institutions and the damage that's done. And this is really what I think this film taps into Gibney's fascinations, because it's about the Church of Scientology. So it's tapping into that, another, again, the institution of religion, and also religion and celebrity and Hollywood. But through the eyes, not just of Lawrence Wright and I guess the way in which his book informs this, but the testimonials of those people who've left the church or been excommunicated from the church, and quite high-profile ones as well, particularly the filmmaker Paul Haggis, who was one of the most famous Scientologists at the time, and directed Crash, the Oscar-winning Crash, not the good Crash directed by David Cronenberg, and also people who were quite high up, as you mentioned before, spokespeople within the church, and talking about practices within the church, the history of the church.
And a lot of the power comes from, you see the person acting as spokesman. People may remember the famous exchange between BBC reporter and one of the spokesmen, and he denies vociferously and angrily that he's ever been physically intimidated, and then the camera switches from that, where he's the spokesman, to the turncoat who's talking to the documentary and says, yes, of course I was assaulted, of course it happened. So just in stripping any of the detail away, it's powerful, because you have the high-profile people completely recanting and turning on the church.
It's one of these strange documentaries, and this is an issue that's raised within the documentary itself, this idea of intimidation and how has the church maintained its power, or the allegations about how the church has maintained its power. And I've had film critic colleagues who've even sort of said, I don't really feel like I really want to talk about this. This film seems to have this sort of strange cloud of nervousness around it, and what can we say and how much can we say. And this is clearly something that Gibney contended with when he premiered this on HBO in America last year, and they had a legal team of over 160 people vetting the material and making sure that this was fit to go to air and kind of, you know, lawyer-proof, I guess. But that hasn't stopped challenges to the film at various ports around the world.
I don't know. I was looking at... I went to a few of the church lengthy letters from the church written to the director, looking at their claims, and tell you what, it came down pretty clearly on the side of the filmmaker, in my mind. It's pretty rapacious. It takes a lot of people's money, and there's a lot of intimidation going on. The evidence is... It stacks up pretty well on one side.
And David Miscavige, the head of the church, John Travolta and Tom Cruise, I think were all asked to appear on camera.
Yes, of course.
And of course, perhaps not surprisingly, all denied.
Actually, have a listen to a part of Going Clear. It deals with Tom Cruise. It cuts in a whole lot of different performances of Tom Cruise's, church videos, interviews that he did for them, and the way that the church dealt with Tom Cruise. Have a listen.
They were away for more than a year, shooting Eyes Wide Shut in the UK, and Cruise was not in touch with Miscavige, and this drove Miscavige crazy.
I was assigned to get him back in, and that was coincident with, and I was to facilitate the breakup with Nicole Kidman.
How'd you do that?
Well, through a lot of auditing. And every session I ever gave to Tom Cruise, and there was dozens upon dozens of them over a three-year period, I had to write detailed reports and send them directly to David Miscavige.
I would sit there every night with our scotch and watch and listen to Miscavige comment about Cruise's sex life and what, you know, how perverted he was. Why is he getting daily reports on Cruise?
Miscavige really wanted to get him back into being somebody that he could use to lure people into Scientology and increase his own status.
So that's the people dealing with Tom Cruise, talking about his relationship with the head of the church, David Miscavige. Auditing is the, I guess, the interview process that forms the core part of Scientology and the way it is practiced. What did you think of the film, Josh?
Yeah, I thought this was really impressive. This is an incredibly dense documentary. I mean, this covers a lot of ground.
Do you think it's dense?
Look, I think so. I mean, in terms of the issues that it taps into are quite wide-ranging and wide-reaching in terms of what is the relationship between religion and celebrity and religion and Hollywood, between the US government and religion. I mean, it gets into quite a detailed section about the IRS and the tax breaks given to Scientology. It also an interesting character study. I mean, the first section of the documentary is focused on L. Ron Hubbard and the relationship between science fiction, artistic designs, and religion and money. And I think
it's pretty amazing footage of him talking, actually.
Really incredible, and weds those together in a really coherent manner. I think this is really strong. I mean, Gibney's an incredibly strong filmmaker and incredibly prolific as well. The one thing that I was a little bit surprised to coming to this documentary was that sense of, I feel like I already know this story. I feel like I've gotten what Scientology is about from the general press, and I was still surprised. There are elements within this that even took me aback, and I think that's perhaps its strength. So if there's people listening out there thinking, oh, look, I kind of know it already, I think this documentary does give you a different perspective. And I think one of the strengths of the documentary is the way in which it opens questions about, why did these people get involved? Why is it now that they've left? Why was it? And I guess vulnerable people who enter into a form of therapy that feels very much like a psychoanalytic talking cure, even though we hear L. Ron Hubbard say, it's nothing like psychiatry, how dare you compare the two? I think you can start to understand what it was about these people and what Scientology gave them that was the impetus for them to enter into the church and stay with it for so long.
It's interesting what you say about if you feel you already know it, because I feel both with this and with We Steal Secrets, I have read a lot about the Scientology stuff, especially the St. Petersburg Times examination of them, and the same with the WikiLeaks documentary. I read so many detailed things, and I did with both think, do I really want to sit through this? He is fantastic at drawing a frame around a complex issue. There are not many words. I think the documentary is just over 2 hours. There aren't actually that many words, even in a two-hour feature. And I didn't actually feel it was that detailed. However, he gets to the core issues, and even though I'm sure the Church of Scientology would disagree, I think it leaves you to make up your own mind. He presents a lot of the evidence. I think he gives you a lot of testimony, perspective, and just enough facts for you to sit back and form your own conclusion of what's going on. I think that was the real power and strength of We Steal Secrets. I thought the WikiLeaks one, that maybe his strength was his central character wasn't there to be interviewed, and you know, they just had to use the chat, the web chat, and I thought that was just filmmaking, but he's clearly got a real gift for economical use of language and giving you a lot of information in a entirely digestible. I mean, you don't feel like you've got to take notes. I think it's actually a real triumph for filmmaking.
Yeah, and it doesn't feel just like a simplistic exercise in mudslinging. No. It doesn't feel tabloid. It's more anchored in the experiences of these people and how power functions within these type of institutions. And again, that's a recurrent theme in Gibney's work.
And what I found interesting is when I was reading the church's letters to filmmakers, to film critics, I felt like the film gave me a lot of ammunition to begin to deconstruct the church's offensive in their letters. Look, a lot of you giving me a lot of information about spin-offs. We were talking about Minions. A lot of you mentioning Laverne and Shirley. Clearly, Laverne and Shirley is a spin-off of sorts, but though you all disagree how much they were on Happy Days, let me read one of them. Laverne and Shirley was not a Happy Days spin-off. Laverne was a character on the show, a waitress. Chachi Loves Jody was based around the Howard's daughter and Fonzie's cousin, where they were grown up and living together. That's from Jason in Seaford, who admits he's worried how he knows this. But that's okay. We've been talking about Minions, which is on everywhere.
Everywhere.
And Going Clear, the documentary, which is on...
limited release. You'll find it at Cinema Nova in Carlton and maybe a few other
Palace Cinemas as well. Josh, thanks so much for coming in.
Pleasure.
You can find Josh at Filmology.com and Filmology on Twitter.